Roll sound, Scotty.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
Good morning. Hi, everybody. It's the Stinking Paws podcast with Scott here. Hi. Paul's not with me today, or Charlie, but I'm pleased to say that I've got my other two best mates with me joining me. And in the blue corner, how can I put this? A man who's probably not adverse to covering himself in rubbish to escape certain sticky situations. It's Stephen. Hello.
Salut.
Here's a clue. and in the blue corner... allegedly a man whose bed springs often need oiling, it's Anthony. Hello.
Hello, everybody. Still trying to make sense of this film, but I'm sure you'll help me with that.
And another boxing reference. This is round two. Anthony has joined that elite club, but ever growing club of hosts and guests on this podcast who forget to turn up.
Thanks for just telling the world.
Forget to watch the film, which is we've all done it. Scott once forgot to watch the film, and I forgot to turn up one time. I was wandering around the supermarket when Scott rang me. So we've all done it. You've just joined our club now.
Well, I've got a story for you. I was on the classic film jerks that Stephen was on as well before, and we were doing A Hard Day's Night, and I stayed up till 1 a.m. And they came on, they said, oh, hi, how you doing? And then the guy had literally started the introduction, and the other guy said, I've just realised I watched Help, I didn't watch Hard Day's Night. It's like, thanks for fucking telling me. I enjoyed it, they were nice fellas, but yeah, I stayed up till 1.
You carried on with the show, didn't you, even though you hadn't watched the right movie?
No, we did re-record, yeah.
It was Stephen's selection today, and if you hadn't worked out from the clues or even the title of this podcast, if you hadn't read what the title of this podcast is, we're doing Delicatessen. I mean, the clues are all there. It's 1991's Delicatessen. The trailer is the world's most amazing trailer, but I can't play it because it's just music and the sound of the squeaky bed spring, so it won't give a lot away. I'll talk about the trailer in a minute, but it's traditional in these circumstances where we have a French movie where, you know, I don't speak a great deal of French, and I'm sure you guys don't either, so the trailer will be unintelligible. Let's play the theme to Allo Allo. There we go. So that was the theme to Allo Allo. Before Stephen gives his marvellous synopsis, have you seen the trailer for this?
A long time ago, yeah.
I think I watched it. No, I didn't.
Right. The trailer is mainly the scene on the bed with the squeaky bed springs. And then it goes into that sort of coordination with the girl playing the cello and the guy painting the ceiling and the guy drilling the holes in the toys.
Yeah.
Into this sort of... like the beginning of Once Upon a Time in America, where everything sort of makes this orchestral thing out of noises that are going on. And I remember seeing that trailer back in 1991 when this first got released. And even if you didn't know anything about the movie, the trailer was just enough to intrigue you because of the visual aspect of it. And you're thinking, this looks brilliant. This looks amazing. Stephen, hopefully you've written one of your wonderful alliterative alliterative synopses. Synopses again. We're doing our partridge.
Synopses. Yeah. Not synopsis. Yeah, Partridge just say synopsi, but it is synopsi, actually synopsis. Yeah. Yeah.
What's it all about, Stephen?
Meat man murderer hunts handyman in post-apocalypse apartments.
Meat man murderer. Excellent.
Yeah, and 1,000 little details ensue. Oh, that's what's amazing. Yeah. I really regret, I should have watched this twice. What I sometimes do is I watch a film 2 or 3 weeks before we record, and then I watch it the night before we record, and I should have watched this again, because I must have missed so many little details. Same with Amelie, really. But
yeah,
I still loved it, though.
Stephen will fill in the blanks because he absolutely adores this movie. Okay. I'm going to hand you over to you, Stephen, straight away, because it's your choice. Tell us about Delicatessen. See if you can elaborate a little bit on that, you know, that plot line there as well. But you love this, don't you?
I do. And it was my first introduction to the director, who subsequently went on to much more famous things, really, specifically Amelie. And there are a couple of faces in this that also appear in Amelie in one way or another. Despite the fact that the storyline is basically about a post-apocalypse butchers with apartments above, and the butcher occasionally killing off one of the tenants, and with then, you know, and feeding that person to the other residents with their full knowledge that that's what it is, that the sweet meat. It is a black comedy. Despite all of that, and we've discussed things previously at different times where things have been done by directors, and they're basically a number of music videos put together, and it doesn't quite work sometimes. This, you can see how that might be something that's said about it, but certainly it does work it as a full narrative, and the scenes, as you say, incorporating some musical elements into it with regards to the activities of various different apartment dwellers making noises that all coordinates to make some kind of odd symphony. The characterization, you've got always got some really odd idiosyncratic characters that are just intriguing. You think, well, any of these individuals, you could actually probably make an entire film about them. They're just a side character in this. And we'll go through the different peculiar residents as we go through the review. But this is, you know, a black comedy, so there are lots of laughs in it, despite the subject matter. And it's visually very interesting and in some ways stunning. And you never know what the next thing in it's going to reveal, to be perfectly honest, because it's so odd and off the wall, but entertainingly so. And that's why I like it. It's just, you know, it grabbed me first time around when I watched it. I didn't watch it when it first came out. I think I watched it probably about 2 years later. And then ever since then, it's been one that's, you know, that I watch occasionally when I can, knowing that I enjoy the oddity of it, really.
I was instantly gripped by it. I saw it back in 91. I don't think I'd ever seen anything like it before. You know, the colour palette, the camera angles, the quirkiness of something that is in essence not only a black comedy, but it's also quite horrific. It's a horror film as well at heart, a surrealistic horror.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's absolutely horrendous what is going on, but they pull it off.
Yeah.
They pull off this thing of making it into a comedy, and it seems perfectly, not plausible. It's not that what's happening is plausible, but the film seems plausible. The fact they made a film about this.
It was interesting to see that when it was released in America, it was released as Terry Gilliam Presents Delicatessen.
Just going to say that. Yeah, could say there was a Gilliam thing, but it's similar, but it's not but you can off see Gilliam. It's different.
You know, that Brazil.
Yeah, definitely.
Is not exactly the same, but must have had some sort of influence on this. Stephen, you've seen City of Lost Children as well, haven't you?
Yeah, and a very long engagement as well, which was the other side of Amelie was after.
Yeah.
There's that surrealism in there, but still an oddity that is, in some ways, you're thinking this is a out of order and unrealistic, but because the whole thing works together, it actually, as you say, it works and doesn't seem weird. This end of the scale, as far as when they're first starting out, the filmmakers, this was more of a grim fairy tale type approach where, you know, you've got the people being eaten and people coming up from sewers to snatch people and things like this. But absolutely, you know, I've seen City of Lost Children, which was actually meant to be done before this. It's seen as a semi-sequel to this, but it was actually meant to be done beforehand, but the budget was too large for the new film, these two new filmmakers, so they went with this one first, which was apparently inspired because Juno had lived above a butcher's with his girl, and him and his girlfriend used to joke about the fact that every morning when they heard the knives being sharpened and stuff, that it was to kill the neighbours and it'd be their turn next. So yeah, it then sparked out that. So, but yes, City of Lost Children, I've seen that as well, and we'll probably get round to reviewing that at some point in good time.
The other story about the origin is that he was on holiday in America, and he said the food was so bad it tasted like real humans or something. That was the other origin, but I think the butcher's one sounds a bit more plausible.
It's amazing, you know, how filmmakers get the spark of imagination from the, you know, the strangest things, you know, that led to this. But then obviously there must take some sort of warped creative mind to come up with this. You know, it's a real artist at work, the pair of them that have created this really surreal, colourful. It's engaging all the way through. You can't take your eyes off the screen. Like you said, Andy, in case you miss something, which you said you may have done.
I'm sure I miss so many details if I watch it. I'm sure, Stephen, every time you watch it, do you notice something different? Or
with diminishing returns to some extent now after decades, but it is one of those films, absolutely, where you watch and you do see things. And there's a great thing within this film, really, that is maybe a bit of a more studious observation. But there's a cause and consequence, really, with a lot of things in this, where it's only when on rewatches you start actually piecing it together sometimes, some of the little things. And that could be stuff, you know, to do with, you know, things that the little kids are doing and things like that. It's plays together really well. There's things that you don't notice. I mean, and not this time around watching, but maybe the last time around watching, I'd completely forgotten that when the grandmother is sat there knitting, there's a machine which is basically taking away the wool from the bottom of what she's knitting and feeding it round into the stack next to her that she's actually knitting from. So it's an endless task, because they don't have enough wool for her to be knitting and knitting and knitting brand new things all the time. So she's just continually knitting with the same loop of wool. And that's you know, little things like that that pique your interest. And I know it's been commented before now that the couple where he's making that have the grandmother, that he's making a comment about that he's got two children to feed and all this kind of stuff, and that, you know, making a thing out of that. And I think somebody says, you know, at least you don't have more than that or something over. And you see him, he's got a condom that there's a bicycle repair bits on. On the condom, there's two bicycle repair patches, which is obviously where the two kids came from. Because
it's twice
on, you know, and it's little bits like that that you do get from rewatches. And it's, you know, there's a number of films that we know of that are, you know, that warrant a rewatch and continue to be enjoyable because the filmmakers have taken that intricacy, or there's the reference in it. And I mean, you know, a different ilk of film, but, you know, things like Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and stuff, where there's referencing in there that you pick up on things. But there's plenty of other films that we all like that do have that multi-layered thing where you can just watch it through and enjoy it, watch it through again and go, oh, didn't notice that before. See, that's because of that now. And you pick up on some of the minor threads that are in it, and absolutely. So every time I watch it, you know, I do, you know, enjoy it anew.
Yeah, it almost seems a shame not to watch it a few times, doesn't it? Because you're just completely missing out. I mean, you get that even with songs, you know, or albums, like concept albums. You know, you listen to them once and you don't get, and then you read up. The great thing now, when you got,
have you got any examples of bands that might have done a concept?
It wasn't really a concept album, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, you know.
Oh, that's an interesting.
I was actually thinking more, I don't know, something like Dark Side of the Moon, although probably everyone's listened to that 20 times. But no, you know, there are stories. And the good thing is that being able to do podcasts like this, but also having the internet and all these analysis videos, you do pick up stuff But yeah, the notches on the condom is brilliant. Reminds me when I had my bike and I used to. Yeah.
Well, it, elsewhere in just, in it is he is pumping up his bike tire, so you know that the link. So there's so many layers in this, and it is incredibly interesting. And the rewatching doesn't diminish your enjoyment of it. Like some films, you could eventually go, right, well, I've seen that, and not get anything new out of it. This is definitely one you continue to get something new out of.
I think as a musician, I love the whole rhythm of it. Because you've obviously got the sex scene, which I think is the best sex scene in the history of cinema. Well, man, absolutely brilliant. But then you even get what I call the non-sex scene, where he's with the butcher's wife. They're on the bed testing the springs. There's this sort of rhythm to this whole thing, which I absolutely love. You know, it sort of propels it along. What they do is really clever, is that if you think about it, it's so bleak. Everything that's going on is really bleak and the building's really bleak. But the film's completely joyful, isn't it? It's not like... Yeah. Just a reference to Requiem for a Dream, because that was the last one that came out, wasn't it? But that was quite bleak towards the end. It was a little bit depressing, although there was some hope to it. But this is just more joyful.
And that's because the character that is introduced new into the scenario, which is, you know, arrives pushing his own taxi and then gets charged for it. charged in shoes. But he comes in and he's you know, an innocent abroad. That he's coming in and he's from an entertainment background in a way, despite tragedy that's befallen him. He's somebody who's got a brighter outlook and about, you know, forgiveness and trying to squeeze joy, even macabre joy. So he brings in a different outlook to the place, which is, you know, from our viewer perspective, we're looking at things a bit more through his eyes in some respects. And he is not necessarily the hero as such, but certainly he's that lightening of the mood and the lightening of perspective and brings the comedy into the darkness, really.
Yeah, you know who he reminded me of? You know that guy who tightrope between the World Trade Center towers?
Yes.
You've seen that film, Man on Wire?
Man on Wire, yeah.
Really amazing. What's that guy's name?
I think his name's
Petit, yeah. He's a bit like him because he was also a juggler, wasn't he, as well as a tightrope walker.
Yes.
And he children loved him because he had that sort of wide-eyed look about him. Yeah, he reminded me of him. But yeah, it's brilliant when he comes in.
Have either of you got any sort of thoughts or ideas as to where this is set? Because, you know, in some descriptions it's described as post-apocalyptic or, you know, or is it an alternate universe? Is it, where did you sort of get it to be?
Well, there's a reference in it which has been picked up by other people who are more into this nonsense than me, is that the woman who is the pseudo wife of the butcher, not actually his wife, but is trading favours with him and to stay and live off her beauty, as it were. She makes a reference to the fact that they're about to enter the age of Aquarius and, the change that's going to bring, and that apparently people who are into this nonsense have the you know, in astrology, the age of Aquarius is actually something like in like 2000 years or something, so it's far flung in the future, thousands of years in the future. But obviously the way in which there's a lot of technology which is from the 50s and further back, that archaicness, which is something that is done elsewhere. There's that feel to it, similar as what Wes Anderson does, where it has a bolder feel to some of the stuff that's in it and the appearance, despite the fact that it's set more modern. I think it could feasibly have been from 1991, it could feasibly have been set 20 years in the future or 20,000 years in the future, to be perfectly honest. But I don't think it's a different dimension or a different universe or anything like that. I think it's just a matter of time. Of our own developing or collapsing into this, really.
Yeah, you think future because it's one of those dystopian, the ideas of the future are always dystopian, aren't they, generally in films? But then the beauty of it is that they're still dealing with, you know, relationships and having to eat, and, you know, they're dealing with all the stuff that you're always going to be dealing with no matter what time it is. You know, if you go back to 1000 BC, people are still need to eat and they're still having relationships with each other.
And that's something that's, you know, said about the TV series Walking Dead, that, you know, it's all about a zombie apocalypse, but most of that program is about relationships between husbands and wife and best friends and etc. This, you know, there's a subcurrent to this which has been picked up by some people and don't think needs expansive elaboration really, but there's a subcurrent to it that there's a sort of commentary on the Second World War and occupation and the resistance movement and, you know, the foreign airmen being shielded and protected from taken away and killed by the occupation forces and stuff. There's been a lot of things that can be said about that, but it doesn't really hinge upon that as a film. I think that's an idea in there, which I think is true, but I don't think it's laboured. It's something that is just an aside that you either pick up on or you don't, and it doesn't really matter if you don't, to be perfectly honest.
I think it gives it total freedom, doesn't it, not setting it at a time? Because if you set it in, say, the 50s, there'll always be someone who'll go, oh, there's a car there in the background that, you know, didn't come out until 1961 or whatever. There's always that. But if you don't give any idea of the time, you can just do what you want. You can have references to the past, you can have references to the future.
Yeah, free reign, yeah, basically.
Totally free reign, yeah.
One thing I was going to point out, the cinematographer is a guy called Darius Congi. Okay, and we were talking about influences or, you know, visually similar films. He was the cinematographer or the director of photography on Seven.
Right.
So you can see that sort of colour palette, because do you remember it was always raining in Seven and it was always gloomy and dark, and there was absolutely no sense of any hope in that film, if you remember. That was the complete opposite to this. It was so bleak, that movie, absolutely. And he's gone on to direct lots of other things. He's always worked with Jeanette and Caro and did the Alien movie as well, you know, which, you know, had their own unique stamp on it. And talk about Wes Anderson, the colour palette of this movie. All right, Wes Anderson probably chooses slightly brighter colours, but it's one of the things that stands out is that whole visual aspect. As I said when I first watched it, I don't think I'd ever seen anything like it.
It's one of the director trademarks, really, that, I mean, it's including we've spoken about before when we've done Amelie, the fact that the colour palette in that is very distinctive. Particularly green and red in that, but in this there's brown and there's orange and there's green, and how much of that is meant to actually tie in with the feeling of decay, because obviously those colours often crop up when you're getting fruit going off and rotting and stuff. But still there's, you know, she's wearing, the daughter character is wearing a green cardigan, as opposed to the pseudo wife wearing a red one and etc. But there's that colour scheme, absolutely, the browns, the yellows, orange, you know, green.
Do you know what you're describing? '70s lounge wallpaper. It's that.
Yeah. Well, absolutely, yeah.
It's the colour palette that we grew up with in the 70s, basically.
Well, absolutely. Brown was the colour of the 70s in, you know, despite disco and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Brown was the colour of the 70s, and that ties in with what we're saying about this harkening back to a different...
It's all there, you know, the yellow fog, things like that.
Which is like a mustard gas type thing, isn't it?
There's a First World War reference, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just quickly going back, Anthony, I know when Stephen introduced the fact that he was going to, you know, be bringing this time around, last time we spoke, you were sort of unsure as to whether you'd seen it. This isn't your first time watch, is it?
I think it is. What happened was, I got a vague memory of a student party, and you know how they often go. So I don't remember what state I was in, but I remember someone showing me a bit of it, and I saw the sex scene, but I'd remembered it wrong. I'd remembered loads of people in the same apartment building having sex at the same time, so I had remembered it slightly wrong, but I remember, yeah, I have vague memories. I'm pretty sure I did see it, but again, it goes into that category of ones that you don't remember anything about, so it felt familiar, but first proper watch, I'd say. Like I say, I wish I'd watched it again, to be honest. Should have got up early this morning and watched it, but there you go.
Stephen and I have got that usual feeling of jealousy now, because going back to watch this for the first time, Stephen, you know, it probably had the same effect on you as it did on me, because you absolutely adore the movie, as you say. But for Anthony to have been watching this for the first time and loving it 30 years plus down the line... That must be something special.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've, you know, there is a certain amount of envy there that when people do get the chance to watch something like this for the first time. And despite what we've said about the fact that it definitely is enjoyable from rewatches, you know, you already know to some extent what you're getting and that you're going to enjoy it. Whereas the first time watch, you still got that novelty of just not knowing what the next thing is going to bring. You know, I watch it now and I know the ultimate conclusion of this and where it's going. And maybe I don't always remember individual elements in it until I see them and it floods back to me. Whereas you watching it for the first time, it is this. And especially with it being such a idiosyncratic type of filmmaking and storyline and etc., it's not possible to, like some other films, you can perhaps predict the denouement. Whereas this, you might have been able to go, oh well, it'll turn all right in the end, but how it turns out in the end probably didn't involve so much plumbing knowledge and Australians.
Steve, were you vegetarian when you first saw this?
Yes,
you were. Okay. No, I was just wondering if, you know, perhaps this might have been the movie that influenced
it. Broke it. No, fortunately not. No, I'd been a vegetarian for at least 5 years by this point, but it definitely didn't encourage me back. I know it might have made you your latent cannibalistic tendencies, it might have revived those and tempted you back, but for me, it was, thankfully, I didn't feel that. It also didn't inspire me to eat snails or frogs either, to be honest.
I mean humans are overrated, really, aren't they? Am I talking about the meat or the people? I'm not sure.
I would say both, really. Some are just walking meat anywhere, despite anything. I wouldn't say that this made me feel any clean that I was missing or pangs that I was missing meat, definitely.
Sorry, I was just going to say there was a great quote in one of the reviews that I read that said, people may be chopped up and eaten by a small-minded, isolated community of weirdos, but this is hardly the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I think some of the close-ups, isn't there a close-up of the snails when he's eating the snails? That's one of the hallmarks of this director, isn't it, the close-ups and the
off with close-ups anyway with that the trash can, the phrase that people might understand. There's a lot of close-ups with it, but yeah, when he's eating the snails and he's actually apologizing, or not quite apologizing to him, but explaining to them as he's eating them why he's having to do so, because they've all got names.
And you think about it, if this was 91, this is pre-CGI, so that whole scene with the snails in the apartment,
real snails,
how many of those were real, or
they were well trained though, weren't they?
Yeah,
well trained snails,
yeah, pre-CGI. Can we just talk about the guy that tries to commit suicide throughout the movie? Yeah, is it? Yeah,
the woman that tries to commit suicide because she's got the whispering voices.
Just the theme throughout the movie of her trying to end her life.
And it's the Wolf's Fantastic Machines, or I can't remember the equivalent that they had over in America, the contraptions that were over elaborate in order to do one simple task. But this is, you know, there's an amazing one where, well, it happens a couple of times, but there's one where she's, you know, she's trying to hang herself, and there's also going to be a gun that goes off if the door is open and shoot her at the same time. And at the same time, she's got the gas oven on and she's got a mouthful of pills to overdose on. So she's trying like five different ways to kill herself. And because something misaligns, the shotgun goes off and shoots down the rope. She falls down. She hits her head on the oven and closes the door and spits out all the pills. And it's that, you know, almost Final Destination in reverse, of the calamity of events that ends up being that she doesn't actually end up killing herself as she would like to do. But again, that shot with an angle on the camera and to some extent rapid fire as well, which you could miss some of the elements. And it's done, you know, it's you know, probably a minute or so of screen time, which you could imagine in some other films that might be make more of that, but this is just a blink and you miss it almost. But when you watch it through another time, you go, oh, I just realised she spat all the pills out, or, you know, I didn't realise she had them in her mouth, or whatever.
Do you know what he is? He's this Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah.
And it's not the first time that I look, you know, parts of this film reminded me of a cartoon, like a Looney Tunes or a Tex Avery cartoon. The whole scene with the flooding of the bathroom and opening the door and the water, you know, spilling out throughout the entire apartment. That is just the cartoon brought to life on celluloid, isn't it? You know, there's lots of things like that. But the whole suicide thing was just like a Roadrunner cartoon.
Yeah. And the American Rube Goldberg, I think is the name, where they got the same as what we had with Will for all the contraption devices to try and achieve something like almost automated just by balls dropping off a shelf onto a spring to then go and twist around a paddle and, you know, what bits of water filling up a jug that's then going to tip over and all these, you know, all that kind of stuff. She's
a mousetrap.
I was just going to say, it's a board game, wasn't there, where that happened? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but, yeah, mousetrap.
Was it mousetrap? That takes me back.
Or if, for the older listeners, those that remember the Professor Brainstorm books, it was the illustrator was a guy called Heath Robinson, who used to design all these amazing contraptions. I think Harry Hill played him in the TV version of it, but it's exactly that sort of thing. Yeah, Mousetrap's a good reference, yeah.
Yes,
but
yeah.
Again, as I say, it's all stuff this is complex, thought out and scripted and, you know, directed with, you know, pinpoint accuracy, but it's an aside. It's not this whole plot of this, the reasoning behind this woman feels like she needs to be committing suicide. That whole thing is a background thing that's not properly elaborated on. It's there, you find out the details of it, but it's not the main thing of what's going on. It's not even the secondary storyline. It's just, but they packed so much into this in the runtime, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
Whereas, as I said at the beginning, you could make an entire film just about this woman's suicide attempts and the reasons behind it, and then what the lengths she goes to try and have these ultimately failed suicide attempts. But it's an aside. It's an aside of an aside, even.
Was this film popular? Because I was thinking there must be a cult. There must be a delicatessen cult. You know, as in cult of fans who love this film.
It achieved a cult following straight away at the beginning.
You can imagine it.
Which, yeah. You know, obviously you can well understand because of the fact that it's quirky, for want of a better phrase, where it ended up being that it gained momentum since then with, you know, which is why it ended up them being able to go on to make things like Amelie and etc. because and get asked to do Alien 3 and stuff, because the momentum had built on it to recognise it's not just a quirky cult film, there actually is the quality within it. It got nominated for a BAFTA at the time.
Yes.
And it, you know, got various other awards foreign wise, including, you know, nominees with the regards to Australia and etc. But there was also, I think there was some, won loads of awards for within French, the cinema awards at the time, because I think I can't remember what they're called, the equivalent of the BAFTAs.
Césars.
It's not Cannes.
Césars. Yeah. So it and across the, you know, it got, you know, that attention, but a lot of it was immediately cult following, and then it gained momentum over the years to be recognised as a real success, and particularly coming from like the first film really from these people, it really did set out a standard for the rest of their careers.
No, so I can imagine the conventions in France, you know, with people dressing up as the characters. I can just picture it somehow. But I think the films that do have depth, they last longer. Even I think most cult films actually. Okay, some cult films are just very basic, but I don't know, stuff like With Nell and I don't know, something like that that's got depth to it, you know.
And that's the thing, yeah. With Nell and I, again, colour palette is there, but despite that being clearly set in the time it was then made in the early 80s, and I think we discussed this when we've done With Nell and I on one of the podcasts, that it stands the test of time because the theme is more universal and doesn't rely upon it the setting of the time and date, people out of work, actors struggling to feed themselves, etc., and not being able to afford to put the heating on and etc. That could have been somebody in the 1930s, or it could be somebody in now. So, and again, with this being set outside of time, being post-apocalypse, this again could, you know, somebody could watch this now and not realize it was made in 1991. They might think it was made a few years ago, but they wouldn't necessarily think it was made in 1991, because it stands outside of time.
Well, when the Pythons made Life of Brian, one of the things they were trying to do, weren't they, was trying to get away from this idea that in biblical films, everyone has to speak with this lofty voice. So when Jesus is giving the Sermon on the Mount, all the poor people at the back, they're going, speak up a bit, you know, they're talking in normal everyday voices. And that's brilliant, you know, showing that, you know, whenever it is, BC or 10,000 years in the future, humans are still going to be dealing with human stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I love about it.
And that's the more universalism. And I mean, this, it been to some extent necessary for there to be that theme that is more acceptable for a film to make it outside of the French language, because we know there's so many people who are funny about watching things in a foreign language, and therefore it's got to have an extra dimension really to make it, which obviously subsequently Amelie absolutely smashed that, but that was quirky rather than just completely odd like this is. So obviously that's why it got and the theme of that, you know, basically a quirky love story, rather than this being okay, there is a quirky love story in this, but it's a different way. Certainly this sets the tone for that, but the cult following side of it is, I think, where it really took off initially, and that's why it stands the test of time.
I remember when it was released, I was working in the video shop, and it had a massive advertising budget in this country. And I just remember it not flying off the shelves as you know, as some of the other, you know, more popular ones were doing, but for a foreign language movie, it really was popular. That's probably what brought it to my attention, because it was like, why are people buying this? What am I missing here?
And that might have been what we've said about people watching it, and then afterwards it's sticking in their minds and thinking, I want to see that again, because I either want to be able to assimilate some of the things that I couldn't quite get my head around, or like Anthony said, I feel like there was some details I missed which enhance it. And as I say, none of those details are things that if you miss them, they spoils it. But certainly, you know, the more you pick up on those, the more you go, oh, right, that's really clever. And the dialogue, and even with the translation into English from French, there were, you know, like, you know, right at the beginning, what is it? He says, I may be a butcher, but I don't mince my words. You know, and the bits and pieces like that. It's just, there's a cleverness to the dialogue, which I think probably, that's the only regret I have with this film, that it probably, if you're somebody who didn't were able to do in translation, but apart from that, yeah, the dialogue still stands up, and it's clever and it's witty, and still, despite all of that intricacy in it, it's to some extent throwaway, because you blink and you miss some of the clever bits, because it's just moving along, and there's no bits in this film where there's a lull where you get a chance really to assimilate what you've just seen. Yeah. It's not until the end where you go, right, what was that then?
What you were saying about people's backstories, particularly the lady that's trying to commit suicide, and, you know, she would merit a movie in her own right. The backstory of Dominique Pignon's clown as well. Now, we don't hear anything about his backstory, but we get little clues, because his clown act is being shown in black and white on the TV. And the chimpanzee, Mr. Livingston, the chimpanzee, I think it's called.
Dr. Livingston.
Dr. Livingston.
He refers to him as the doctor. And then, again, why call a chimpanzee Dr. Livingston in a French film? Not even like it's an English film. So why... And that's, you know, no explanation for that. Nothing's, there's no elaboration or anything. And it just is that's it.
It creates a little spark of wonder in your brain. And before you get a chance to absorb it and think, well, what's that about? Why is that backstory? And boom, something else has appeared on the screen. And you have to like, okay, I'll come back to that later. But you don't get the chance to come back to it because something else is going on. And that is the beauty of this film. And Anthony will have to go back and watch it at least five or six times.
I'm going to go back, yeah, probably in the next couple of weeks, actually.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to have a chat with you when you do rewatch it.
Yeah.
just to see exactly what else you found out about it, because if you loved it as much as we did on the first viewing, I think it's going to become one of those movies that you go back to time after time, not necessarily every year, but you will revisit.
The thing about it is quite, was it 1 hour 40 as well? As you said, it doesn't outstay its welcome, and it just packs an incredible amount into that. Was it what was it, 1 hour 35, 40?
I always get to the point about 20 minutes from the end where I think it's ending. And then you get another 20 minutes of marvellousness afterwards. You know, it just keeps
it's
on
one
going.
It's 1 hour 39.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Yeah. Yeah, brilliant.
Just rattle on, absolutely. And you don't get time to breathe. And you don't realise until, you know, you get into the end and you think, oh, right, it's been that amount of time. I didn't realise. But
yeah.
Can I ask you about, is the woman committing suicide, is that the one who's hearing the voices of the, what they call troglodytes? Is that in her head?
She thinks it's voices in her head, but it isn't voices in her head. The two guys who are, this is a spoiler for anybody who haven't seen it. the two guys that make the sound boxes the cows mooing and stuff. There's one of the brothers, which is the guy who subsequently played Amelie's dad, Rufus. He's soft on her, and obviously the brother, you know, is jealous of this. So he's in the bathroom of their apartment. He's making spooky voices into a pipe that leads up into her apartment, where he can make it that she's hearing voices, because encouraging her to commit suicide, basically, which is incredibly morbid and dark thing, that somebody is trying to encourage somebody else to commit suicide.
So why are they interested in her, though? That's what I wouldn't get from the first meeting. What was the interest?
It's a love interest. One of the brothers is in love with her, and the other brother, who's doing the whispering, is jealous that his brother's going to potentially lose his brother to a woman, and so he's trying to get rid of the woman.
It's his business partner as well, and that toy thing is never ever explained, is it?
I mean, that's an industry, or that's a living that you can make of little, the size of a coffee mug, a device that's got some holes drilled in it that when you turn it over, it makes the sound of a mooing cow. That is something that you can make a living at in any era, never mind in a post-apocalypse. Is bizarre, as you say, it's never elaborated on that.
Those things existed. I remember them as a kid.
I think it just
ticks.
Of course,
they had them in their 20s. Yeah,
they did during the war.
During the war, did they use as the poster the guy poking his head out? Is he poking his head out of
that
a rubbish
bin?
That was one of them.
The main thing was the pig, wasn't it? Was the main?
Yeah.
Oh, the pig. Yeah.
The guy who's the previous one that they that tries to escape the apartment because he realizes he's the meat that's been going to be harvested. So he wraps himself up in rubbish and then hides himself in the bin to be taken away so he can escape and gets discovered, obviously. That's the pre-credits sequence, which is really interesting. That tells you straight away what you're getting with this, to be perfectly honest, that sequence. I'm trying to remember his name, Jean-Claude something, who plays the butcher. Has a great ability to pull a face and be malevolent and mad, really in this, including when he's trying to scare the grandmother and pulling the faces there. But yeah, he's got a great presence about him to be playing that role, I think.
Scott, can I potentially upset your more woke listeners?
Please do. Oh,
it seems
absolutely.
Like, I was going to say, in French films, it seems like they play on having bulbous eyes. So the butcher's got very bulbous eyes. The guy. No, I mean, I'm trying to make. I'm not being offensive here.
No.
But it's a stinking pause, and I can be offensive. Are there a disproportionate number of people in France with bulbous eyes? That's only my question. Because I'm sure I've seen other French films where they seem to play on this. But it is partly the camera work. It's the close-up.
Dominique Pignon.
Maybe we'll just part that, shall we?
What? Dominique Pignon definitely has that face.
Yeah, he's got such an amazing face, hasn't he? Yeah. Amazing features. Yeah, I think they used the fact they used him was brilliant because he was in Amelie. He was the one who was having a romance in a in the cafe, wasn't he? Is that right?
He was one in the cafe who was jealous. You know, manages to he wants one of the waitresses, and then he ends up getting directed towards the other. So he's in Amelie. There's also obviously the father of Amelie is in this. Who's the one that's got the love interest in the suicide woman. The guy who's repairing the condom, he's one of the pictures that's talking to each other in the photo album of torn up photo strips. So there's a number of people in this that are reused, but no, the bulbicized things, I mean, you know, they go overboard with that when there's the guy who has the snails and the frogs who he puts on the goggles that are made out of two ping pong balls, and then puts the party blower in his mouth with glue on to try and catch a fly to basically turn himself into a frog. You know, there's another character in this, I think, that's got you know, the wandering eye, and that's looking to the left while the rest of the eyes, you know, the other eyes looking forward. No, I think that, you know, that it's the quirky features of people is something that's emphasized within this film, particularly given the post-apocalypse and the great characterization of just odd characters, really. I think they've all got some odd look about them, really.
Well, there's something we've definitely talked about probably when we did Amelie. I was saying that in Italian cinema as well, they like close-ups and they're quite interested in people's faces, you know, and you maybe don't get that so much in American films. Probably do a little bit, but you know, they find in people with interesting faces, and the camera seems to linger on them a bit more, you know.
I think it adds more to that cartoon element we were talking about as well. When you've got a face that tells a thousand stories, like Dominic Pignon's, he only has to like move an eyebrow or purse his lips or something, and it's just this wonderful, almost like a spitting image puppet. We were talking about Walter Matthau, weren't we, in Pelham? That face, that dill pickle nose, just tells a story, doesn't it?
I think you've got an
inverse with European cinema, particularly and to some extent us British, with the American films, really, that there's a perception there where, you know, everybody is to some extent beautiful or good looking, and there's maybe one character who's the ugly quirky friend, or sometimes as the ugly quirky lead character that ends up being the beautiful character in the end when they're turned around and dressed up and given the right clothes and makeup. But whereas in European cinema, you've got more where there's, you know, there might be one character that's the suave, good-looking, hunky or beautiful woman, and the rest of the character around it are much more homely-looking or quirky-looking, with the odd features, which obviously none of us three suffer from, but the rest of the populace do tend to be more ordinary-looking.
Yeah, because in Amelie, I mean, obviously Audrey Tautou, she's a beautiful woman, but she is a beautiful woman, yeah. But then she's not the model type. She's more, like I said, homely, you know.
She's that natural.
Which I prefer, frankly.
She's that natural prettiness rather than something that is all hair and makeup, yeah.
Yeah, and Photoshop as well sometimes.
Final thoughts then, it's brilliant. Yeah, you loved it for your first time watch, mate.
Yeah, like I say, a bit gutted I didn't watch it again before this, but I will watch it again soon. Just to say, as I said, the musical element, the theme at the beginning with the accordion, again, it sounds very French, and a waltz with an accordion, you know, but I just know that.
What about the bit where Dominic Pignon's playing the saw as well?
I was going to say as well, yeah, because when I was in Madrid, I met this guy who had a musical saw, and it was the first time I'd ever seen anyone play it. Yeah, those duets they do, and the way they end the film as well, with them, they're on the roof, aren't they, just playing a little duet?
Yeah,
it's just fantastic. You know, I love the musical elements. As a musician, I particularly picked up on that.
So it's not all visual, this movie, then?
Yeah, no, not at all. No,
we've been focusing on the visual aspects, but there is a lot more to it, the sound elements. Yeah,
that's the sound beyond just music. The sounds more generally. I mean, obviously some of it is sounds combining to make a musical tableau, but that there is various bits where the sound is quite important to, you know, creating a character or creating the scene. And that, you know, is, it is very much the artistry of this, I think.
This film, yeah, it ticks so many boxes. And even the minimalists, you know, there was a movement in the 50s and 60s, John Cage and all those people of using, well, they were using silence, but they were also using, making music out of household instruments and stuff. There's a bit of that, isn't there?
Yeah, the found sound as well, which was found being sound, done by a number of artists at one point, particularly 70s and 80s. That is, Gary Newman did a big thing of going around actually sampling things like gates shutting and things like that. But no, there's very much the soundtrack, as it were, which is not the music as usually soundtrack is, the actual just soundscape of this. It's done incredibly well. The accordion, you know, any of us hear an accordion, we automatically think French in a way. But interestingly, you know, there is the performance of him in the re-showing of the circus act on television, it's Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside, which is, you know, you automatically wouldn't think of that being in a French film. You think that is very, very, very much, you know, British, English, Blackpool, you know, Northern Seaside particularly. But now there you go. It's the way things are used. So it's very clever. Film.
Am I misremembering, or am I sort of confusing this with Eraserhead? But in the background, is there like a constant sort of like industrial hum going on throughout the movie? Or am I just misremembering?
Well, there is in Eraserhead and also The Elephant Man, because we just reviewed Eraserhead.
Is it in this film as well?
It's not your hearing aid, really.
It probably is. It's my attitude again. Yeah. All right, forget that one.
No, what it is. What it is that there isn't actually a hum in this, but there's your neighbour has got a pipe going from their bathroom into yours, and they're just humming all the time to try and make you think, and hopefully you're going to get into some situation where elaborate contraptions to top yourself.
And on that note,
Steve, final thoughts, because you love this movie. I mean, you've just extolled its virtues throughout this particular episode, but is there any more you can add to your love for this movie?
No, I think I've said all the essentials. It really is it's not something everybody's going to enjoy, because some people can't take anything that's not ordinary. And the traditional narrative, traditional setting for a film, and anything that they have to think about. But other than that, it is a film that is so detailed and so quirky, and but still has at its core a simple story. I think it's something that is very easy to enjoy, despite what we've said about its complexities. And it's something that I recommend people go and make the effort to see, even if you don't normally like subtitled films and etc. This really is a standout of foreign film for me, and it's one that absolutely warrants a rewatch decades on, to be perfectly honest.
Wonderful. Okay, Delicatessen 1991. My selection for you guys after the break, we're going back a further 50 years. I'll let you know what it is after this.
Preview time. When it comes to entertainment, you can't beat a good film. So let's take a look at what's coming your way.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your thoughts and your feedback on Delicatessen. Excellent choice, Stephen. I think you'll agree with that, Anthony, won't you, mate? Because that was a bloody good movie.
Yeah, very good, yeah. Tick lots of boxes and lots to think about. Yeah.
Okay. I spoke to you guys off mic before we started that this particular choice that I've got for you next time is possibly from not necessarily one of your favourite directors, but certainly one that you have seen a fair few of his movies. I've got a good feeling that you probably haven't seen this one. The director is the director of the original Scarface, Rio Bravo, Big Sleep, Red River, Bringing Up Baby, Howard Hawks.
Right.
Okay. So you'd have seen some or all of those movies, yeah?
Yeah.
Generally regarded as one of the kings of the screwball comedy. 1941, he directed a movie that was sort of co-written by Billy Wilder, one of Stephen's favourites. Mm. Starring Gary Cooper. Barbara Stanwyck won the Best Actress for this. Dana Andrews is in it. You've got the wonderful character actor Oscar Homolka in it. S.Z. Sakal from Casablanca, you'll recognise. Henry Travers from It's a Wonderful Life plays Clarence. He's in it.
Yeah, right.
A very young Richard Hayden, who was in The Sound of Music, is in it as well. It's called Ball of Fire.
Ooh.
Okay. I can describe it as a screwball comedy, but it's also a modern reworking of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, right? Basically, what happens... there's a group of professors that are holed up, right, in a Manhattan mansion, and they're all working on the definitive...
Is this the encyclopedia?
The encyclopedia, you've seen it.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, I know of it, and it's one that I've got in the past. I might watch that sometime, but that was years ago, and I never got around to it, so this is great.
Right. What they're doing, Anthony, is they're compiling like the ultimate encyclopedia, and each one of these professors is a specialist in their certain field. So one is like science, one is like on culture, one is like whatever. And Barbara Stanwyck turns up on their doorstep escaping from the mob. So it's like Snow White turning up and disturbing these seven professors that are diligently at work on this encyclopedia. And the screwball element comes in with all these wonderful characters. Gary Cooper playing out of character as this rather stiff, stuffy professor who falls in love with Barbara Stanwyck. But at the same time, Dana Andrews as the mob leader trying to track down Barbara Stanwyck, getting involved with them. It's an underspoken gem, as far as I'm concerned. It's one of my favourites. I always put it in the same mould as Frank Capra, but there's definite Billy Wilder elements in there because of the screenplay. Howard Hawks' screwball fingerprints are all over it. It won't be too taxing. It is a very funny comedy, 90 minutes or so, guys. I think that's what we're going to bring to you next time.
Brilliant. When you said screwball comedy, I was a bit worried it was going to be that. What's that Cary Grant one about the media? It was, the dialogue was so fast, I couldn't get past 10 minutes. Yeah, that's it. Girl I couldn't Friday, get past 10 minutes of that.
Yeah.
So, is it going to be easier than that?
Yeah, no, it's quite gentle, and you'll recognise most of the professors from other movies of the era. Gene Krupa, the famous drummer in his orchestra, makes a guest appearance at one point.
That's great.
I just wanted something a bit lighter and a little bit more classic Hollywood than sort of, we've been sort of second half of the 20th century recently. So let's go back a little bit and go back to something I was hoping you hadn't seen. So there you go, guys. That'll be next time.
What's it called? Yeah. Ball of Fire.
Ball of Fire, 1941.
All right.
Right. All that remains is me to thank Stephen once again for bringing the marvellous Delicatessen to the table. Yeah, oh, to the table. There we go. This time round, thank you, mate. Wonderful choice.
No problem at all. Adieu.
And to Anthony, who is going to spend a couple of seconds just rattling off where he can be found on his other podcasts.
Yeah, Glass Onion on John Lennon. We've had lots of guests. We've had Scott Phipps, and then we had Scott Phipps as well.
That was it.
And in the future, we'll have Scott Phipps.
I'm back on another
and one. And some Quarrymen and that bloke from 2001 who threw a bone in the air. Some other nobodies and then Scott Phipps. And then Film Gold, you've both been on there. It's obviously about films, leaning more towards older stuff or Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, Hitchcock, that kind of thing. And then Life Only is psychology and alternative media. Yeah. Nice to be on again. I'm glad you brought this film to the menu. Yeah.
Any other French gags before we go?
Sorry to the French listeners about the bulbous eyes comment. But to any French listeners who do have bulbous eyes, then I think I've proved my point. So, yes.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's where they get an Eiffel Tower off.
Bye. We could do another half an hour of puns if you want, Scott. Just if you want to leave yourself.
Cheers, guys. Bye.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Take care.
The management of this theater suggests that for the greater entertainment of your friends who have not yet seen the picture, you will not divulge to anyone the secret of the ending.
Master at Arms, that infernal jamboree is worse than two cats on a fence.
You dudes get lost now, you hear?
Good night, ladies.
Good night, sir.
When you feel down, try positive thinking. That's what I told the man, said, don't wear a frown. Try positive thinking. Laugh at your troubles instead. You've got to look on the bright side. On hope so much depends. With your confidence sinking, positive thinking helps you on the way, my friend. When things look black, try positive thinking. Treat every season as spring, no glancing back. Try positive thinking. Trust what tomorrow may bring. This crazy world that we live in will keep on spinning round, but with good, strong, positive thinking, we'll get together and life won't let us down.
Shut up, you ugly bitch.
Oh, shut up. We enjoy it.